Okay, so today I'm here with Reza, and we are going to talk about Hassan Rouhani, Iran's president, his sort of his cabinet choices. So in the, previously in the series, we've discussed Rouhani's role in politics and history in Iran, sort of the current state of Iran's economy, and the IRGC role, the IRGC and the sort of security apparatus's role in Iranian politics. So today we're going to do sort of a little more insider baseball and sort of look at, these cabinet choices because, as sort of will be clear in our conversation, the president does have control over sort of the domestic sphere, and sort of these cabinet choices does affect how Iran is run and sort of how Iran sort of interacts with the wider world. So let's start off with Reza. Walk us through the process of how these cabinet ministers are decided, because it's, for somebody who doesn't really know a lot about Iran's politics, this is the very process of choosing these ministers is strikes me as very much insider baseball, give and take. You put this guy here to satisfy this constituency. You put this guy in this ministry to, for this constituency. So walk us through, I mean, what is sort of the process that Rouhani has been following to select his cabinet ministers?
So just before I get into that, I just wanted to just as kind of to put all of this in context, give just a very, very brief summary of the situation that Rouhani is actually coming to power, and the conditions of the country currently, and kind of knowing and understanding that, I think will give us a better understanding and appreciation of the process itself, and also why the reason behind a lot of these picks. As many people know, Ahmadinejad's presidency for 8 years was very controversial, and because of his kind of bombastic and dogmatic policies, domestically and abroad, Ahmadinejad created a lot of divisions, between the conservatives, reformists, even, various kind of degrees of conservatives in Iran. Even between them, he was creating tensions and divisions, challenged the supreme leader on multiple occasions. And, again, because that's not what the conversation is, but, kind of knowing that, now this situation has created a big challenge for Rouhani and his government to be. He has to kind of keep both sides content. He has to kind of keep the reformists content, who have been for the most part isolated and put aside after 2009 and disputed election, and try to perhaps bring them back into the fold and keep them content. At the same time, he has to keep the traditional conservatives, people around the supreme leader and his camp, happy, content, and perhaps not threatened by giving too much power to the other side. So he has to kind of play this game, and so far, kind of looking at his picks, it seems very clear that that's the game he's trying to play, and for the most part he's done a good job. Now, as far as the process of selecting the cabinet, it kind of differs president to president. For example, Ahmadinejad just kind of went about it, from what I understand, without that great of a plan. He just kind of started giving favors to people around him and individuals who he felt that were loyal to him. And in the process, he kind of disfranchised and isolated a lot of the other camps, especially the good technocrats, the experienced individuals who actually have been managing the country since the early days of the revolution. Rouhani took a completely different approach. What he did, he actually first he put together a transition team first, headed by Akbar Tuğrul Kağan, who was actually Hashemi Rafsanjani's defense minister. back in the day. And that's another trend that you're going to also notice as we are talking, is that many of Rouhani's picks kind of come from the Rafsanjani camp, the Kargozaran Sazandegi, or the constructive party, the head of the so that it comes from the Rafsanjani camp and that those individuals and executives of construction party, sorry. The Torkan team was then tasked, as the head of Rafsanjani's transition team, to actually put together a report that would reassess the state of the country. And this was a very comprehensive report that was supposed to tell Rouhani about the state of the country's economy, the foreign policy, domestic politics, and social-cultural issues. And according to Rouhani, based on the recommendation of this report, based on the weaknesses and strengths of the country, Rouhani then planned to pick the good technocrats that could, you know, use the tools available to them to the best of their abilities to actually remedy a lot of the problems that the country is facing. So then what happened is, based on that report, as I said, there was a big, you know, kind of transitional committee or a transition team was put together, and it was broken up to four committees. The committees, you know, consisted of economy, foreign policy, domestic politics, and social culture issues. Now, each committee was then divided into 20 different subcommittees that, in return, apparently asked more than 500 experts, scholars, previous, you know, diplomats, technocrats, experienced politicians about their advice and their suggestions. And based on their recommendation, Rouhani actually came up with his cabinet. So as you can see, you know, already from the get-go, it seems like that he is planning. He has kind of a vision. He does recognize, I think, the gravity of the situation, the very poor and feeble state of the economy, Iran's isolated role, you know, in the world, and, you know, so on and so forth with everything else, you know, that Iran is facing. I think Rouhani does realize and recognize that he has to pick the best of the best. And he seems to be true to his original promise of forming a unity government. That's what he kept saying during his campaign, that this is not going to be a government based on, you know, nepotism and personal favors. This is going to essentially be a government that would use anyone with talent and expertise to actually help the administration. So hopefully that kind of explained the process. I don't know if you have any specific questions about that, but maybe we could actually go, you know, into the, you know, kind of like the nitty-gritty of like the names of the individuals and what they are about, and we could assess it that way.
Well, before we do that, I'm sort of curious, how is a cabinet organized in Iranian politics? You know, is it sort of like, you know, the U.S. president's office, you know, here, you know, going from the president to a chief of staff to the ministers and then to the majlis or the parliament or whatever, you know, how is it? You know, what is the sort of broad view of how the ministers, you know, interact with Rouhani, his chief of staff, and with the majlis? You know, give us a broad view, because I think...
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you know, no, I think that's a great question. I mean, there are some similarities to like what the U.S. presidency would be. But then, of course, there are, you know, clear differences as well. Constitutionally, the Iranian president does have the right to pick his own cabinet ministers. And that's a constitutional right given to the president, which kind of avid Iran followers remember actually the controversy between Ahmadinejad and the supreme leader over this, because Ahmadinejad was claiming that he's not giving enough, he's not, you know, having enough independence to pick some of his own ministers. So Constitutionally, yes, the president has the right to pick his own candidates, but traditionally there are four key ministers that the supreme leader has to give his blessing to, and that's the intelligence minister, interior minister, foreign minister, and the oil minister. The supreme leader supposedly is, you know, unofficially kind of shown a list, and he does either bless it or not. Even with the current ministers, unofficially, again, there have been reports that Rouhani was, you know, submitted a list to the supreme leader like three times, supposedly, you know, and he had to keep, you know, he had to like refine the list that was ultimately approved. Now, an Iranian president has the chief of staff, which is somewhat similar to what a role of a chief of staff is in the United States, essentially in charge of making sure that the office of the president is running. He's like the main point of contact, you know, for the president, between the president and the ministers. And he's kind of the guy who cracks the whip, you know, when necessary, and that's what he does. There's the first vice president, which, you know, he acts as kind of the president's confidant and right-hand man. And after that, you have your various ministers, you know, culture, labor, urban development, education, health, foreign policy. And when they are picked, they list, supposedly after it's, you know, kind of blessed unofficially by the supreme leader, this list of candidate is then submitted to the parliament. The parliamentary members kind of vet the candidates. They look at their resumes, their experiences, their loyalty to the system, many, many, many different consideration, perhaps party loyalty. You know, if it's a conservative parliament, you might have a harder time, you know, getting a reformist approved. You know, that's perhaps not that unique to the Iranian system. I mean, other systems kind of deal with these type of issues as well, the nomination process and then, you know, getting them approved. So, but after they are approved, you know, then they, you know, take their posts, start working, and there are cabinet meetings, there are regular cabinet meetings between them and the president, and they, again, more or less just like any other country, they report frequently to the president about the various projects they're working on and how they are, you know, what the challenges are, what the weaknesses are, what the successes are. So that's for the most part how the government, you know, functions. And, you know, it's just kind of like, maybe this is kind of stating the obvious, but it, you know, it's the executive branch. So they essentially manage the country, you know, and as you can tell, I think sometimes, you know, we don't get into the nitty gritty things of, you know, the nitty gritty bureaucratic, you know, system, or the Iranian bureaucratic system, and it's often presented as you know, kind of like a, I don't know, theocratic, you know, government, which is, but the supreme leader is not. He's not an ultimate dictator. I mean, he has many, many advisors, and he still heavily relies on the executive branch and the president to manage the daily affairs of the country, you know, internationally and domestically.
Interesting. So let's actually just start going through, you know, his candidates. So let's start with that core where he had to sort of, you know, he has to submit a list to the supreme leader. Intelligence, foreign ministry, oil, and defense?
Yes.
So let's start with foreign affairs, because I think, you know, his choice of Mohammad Javad Zarif has been sort of a bit of interest here in the United States, especially, I think, you know, he's U.S. educated, he's spoken in front of U.S. audiences before. But what, you know, why the decision to sort of go with this guy as opposed to somebody who would be closer to the conservative camp?
Right.
Or
yeah, no, that's a great question. I think choosing Zarif kind, you know, definitely sends a strong signal to the West that, you know, Iran is going to be changing its rhetoric. Iran is going to be changing kind of this dogmatic posture that we have been used to see during Ahmadinejad's presidency. I think, as you mentioned, Zarif is someone who knows how to talk to Westerners. You know, he's a diplomat. He's Western educated. Supposedly, there were series of, you know, kind of unofficial secret meetings that were held between Zarif and, you know, UN officials, American officials, and he's already been, you know, in, you know, various capacities involved in negotiation process with the Westerners. And as you mentioned, for the most part, you know, Westerners are very optimistic about Zarif, and they have dealt with him before. They know that he speaks the language of diplomacy. And Rouhani picking him, as I mentioned, I think shows how serious he is about trying to at least change Iran's posture and rhetoric towards the West. And it perhaps is even a signal that Rouhani is serious about the upcoming nuclear negotiations and the preliminary work that goes, you know, into that. So we're going to have to wait and see. There are more pessimistic views that say, well, just because you're Western educated, that doesn't mean that you're pro-democracy or pro-West, which is, I think, is a completely valid argument. But I think dealing with a real diplomat, someone who has, you know, gotten his PhD in international law and policy at Denver University, University of Denver at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies, someone who has held many, you know, conferences, he's publicly spoken at the Princeton University and other venues. You know, he knows, you know, how to at least speak and how to clearly and concisely deliver Iran's message to the West. And yes, that coupled with, you know, Rouhani's personal understanding of Iran's nuclear file, which I know your previous guests have spoken about, could be a very strong diplomatic team, and could potentially remedy the nuclear issue.
Now, on the issue of the nuclear issue, I mean, is this conducted out of the Office of Foreign Affairs? So it would be presumably under Zarif and sort of under the guidance of Rouhani, or
we still have to wait and see. What there have been rumors previously that Rouhani might be thinking about actually taking the nuclear file away from the National Security Council. That's where traditionally the nuclear file has been handled, and there's been you know, kind of suggestions that he may take it away from the National Security Council and actually have it be managed under the Office of the Foreign Minister, which means that then he himself will have direct, you know, kind of say and control over the nuclear file. Now, again, that doesn't mean that they're not going to still have to clear, you know, major decisions by the Supreme Leader. I mean, he's still going to have a say in all of this. But even as far as the management of the file goes, that is a big move if he does actually make the decision to do that. So we're going to have to wait and see what happens there. But, you know, again, Zarif is one of those individuals, you know, that everyone kind of looks up to as a diplomat and is very excited to have on board if he does get actually cleared by the parliament, which I personally believe more than likely he will.
So let's sort of move to, you know, the ministers of intelligence and defense. You know, what were his, you know, for intelligence, he picked Saeed Mahmoud Alavi, and for defense, he picked Hossein Dehghan. So what does that say about, you know, is there a sort of trade-off for Rouhani to sort of, you know, he could put a sort of more Western oriented person at foreign affairs, but then with defense and intelligence, you know, are these, would you characterize these as more sort of conservative picks, more?
Yeah, I mean, I think traditionally, you know, these ministries, defense and intelligence, are such, you know, sensitive posts that traditionally they go to individuals who have proven their loyalty, not just to the governing administration, but also to the system, you know, to the supreme leader himself, to various security institutions and organizations, to the IRGC, to the military itself. So that's a little bit more complicated. And as I briefly mentioned, for the most part, I don't believe those individuals would have been nominated if they already didn't have the blessing of the supreme leader. I mean, Dehqan, you know, has a military background. He was the commander of the IRGC's Air Force. That's how he kind of began his career, and he has had many senior posts and positions within the you know, defense kind of system and structure of the country. As far as the intelligence minister goes, it's more or less the same way, and that's how I would characterize it. As a whole, I think Rouhani is trying to pick individuals that are kind of, you know, old, seasoned, non-ideological technocrats. I mean, I can go through the list of the names. I can give you individuals who have been ministers under the Rafsanjani government, but also under Khatami's government, and they have maybe had advisory roles for in Ahmadinejad government. So these are individuals who kind of don't rock the boat. They are more concerned about doing the job the best way they can. They have weathered many storms through, you know, many ideological camps kind of coming in and out of power inside the country. And Rouhani seems like that he's more concerned about kind of getting the job done, getting by getting good technocrats. He could potentially get a hold of this kind of this array of various issues that he has inherited from his predecessor, and also kind of trying to bring unity back to the badly fractured government and domestic politics of Iran. So, like, for example, you know, in order to kind of drive my point, as his chief of his staff, which I mentioned, is kind of the gatekeeper to the president, he picked Mohammad Nahavian. Now, he is a Western-educated, you know, individual. He has his PhD in economics from the George Washington University. It's my alma mater, actually. And he has served, you know, many senior advisory roles. You know, he was the deputy secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, served under Larijani. He was the head of Iran's World Trade Organization mission. He also was kind of, you know, frequently, you know, traveled to the West back and forth, and is someone who's familiar with the West, and is actually, interestingly enough, a green card holder. He lived in the United States for 8 years when he was getting his degree from the George Washington University, became a permanent resident of the United States. And it was a big controversy, actually, in 2005, when the government actually used Nahavandian to send a message to Zarif. He entered the country under the guise of apparently, like, attending a scientific conference of some sort, but he was actually on a diplomatic mission, more or less. And Larijani at the time told Etemad Milli, a reformist newspaper, that, you know, Nahavandian was on a trip, which caused a big controversy and made actually Condoleezza Rice say that, you know, they're concerned about this. They're going to look into the fact that, you know, if his residency should be revoked or not. You know, there hasn't been much follow-up about that. So, but at the same time, you know, kind of like taking all that in, now Mandion comes from like a very traditional religious family. You know, he has strong ties with the Bazaari class, with the merchant class in Iran. And he attended a very you know, religious and Islamic high school in Iran. So that's kind of like symbolic. Like if you take Nahavandian as an archetype, as a symbol of what a model you know, minister is for Rouhani's cabinet, is someone who kind of has all of that. You know, is Western educated, has the know-how, but at the same time is a seasoned technocrat who has ties, you know, with the religious class, with the merchant class inside Iran, and actually kind of knows how to get the job done. So that's, you know, I kind of throw Nahavandian's name as an example of to kind of for you to kind of get a feel of what type of a administration we are going to be dealing with. And, you know, just kind of to move, you know, ahead and like maybe mention the oil minister, Zangane, he's another great example of such an individual. He's, you know, served both under the Rafsanjani administration, also Khatami's administration. Supposedly, he's respected by his OPEC colleagues. You know, kind of managed a lot of the. He played a big part in managing the war economy during the 1980s. He was involved in the creation of the kind of big, you know, reconstruction programs after the war. Interestingly enough, he actually was the Minister of Energy under Mir Hossein Mousavi's prime ministership in 1988. So as you can see, you know, these are all, you know, they're kind of like, I was actually speaking to a friend yesterday, they are the best of the best as far as the Iranian system is concerned. You know, they, if there are any weaknesses, it's the weaknesses of the system. It's not because of the individuals. You know, I feel like, you know, Rouhani has really gone out of his way to pick the best able individuals for various positions. I mean, there have also been, you know, some picks that I'm certain he has had to kind of, you know, trade in. You know, maybe he has had other individuals in mind for certain positions, but he had to kind of compromise. In order not to compromise the whole government, he has to maybe had to compromise on some individuals and has kind of maybe taken the backup position, if you will, use a sport analogy. But for the most part, these are able individuals.
Interesting. So let's look at the
Minister of Justice and the Minister of Culture and Guidance. So the Minister of Justice is Mostafa Pour Mohammadi, and then Minister of Culture and Guidance is Ali Jannati, excuse me. Okay. But I mean, it seems like these two guys are sort of, you know, at least in the West and U.S. press and sort of people, Iran analysts, these guys are objects of controversy. I mean, walk us through, I mean, why, you know, why are they an object of controversy? And then, you know, walk us through what you think is sort of Rouhani's decision making to put these guys at, you know, these key ministries of justice. Oh, go ahead.
I think that's a great point that you bring up. If we kind of have to pinpoint, you know, at least two individuals, as you mentioned, Mostafa Pour Mohammadi and Ali Jannati are probably the more controversial picks for Rouhani's cabinet. Mostafa Pour Mohammadi was picked as the Minister of Justice, but he has had a long, you know, illustrious career in the intelligence apparatus of Iran. Reportedly, he was actually, you know, he apparently played an active role in the mass murders and the executions of political prisoners in the late 1980s. According to late Grand Ayatollah Montazeri, he also was in charge of questioning the prisoners that were arrested during the tail end of the Khatami's first, administration during the late 1990s. He supposedly also played an active role in what is now known as the chain murders, which was actually a serial assassination killing of dissidents, Iranian opposition members in Iran. So now you have someone like that, who is going to be your Minister of Justice. I know a lot of the activists and Iranian human rights activists and promoters have been mentioning that as a very tragic, ironic point, that you have an individual like that who's been appointed as your Minister of Justice. Now, the reason that he was picked... let me tell you about Jannati as well very briefly, and then we can talk about the reasons that why they were perhaps picked. Now, Jannati is the son of Ayatollah Jannati, who is the head of the Guardian Council. Traditional conservative. He's well known for his social conservative positions he has taken. He's taken a strong stance against the reform movement in Iran. After 2009, he criticized the... harshly criticized the leaders of the Green Movement. Now, that's the father I'm talking about. Supposedly, the son, Ali Jannati, is not as conservative as the father. Supposedly, he is more moderate and he's somewhat closer to what Rafsanjani's kind of point of view is, which is definitely better. But a lot of people are kind of cautiously watching him. In a recent interview, he even made a little bit of fun and said that, social views are not inherited. He said that just because my father is a conservative cleric, that doesn't mean that I am also going to be having the same views. He's argued that he's going to be working very closely with artists and writers and individuals like that to actually promote culture, promote a more free environment for culture and arts in Iran. But who knows? That's someone that, it's raising, some eyebrows, and people are kind of wondering how far the apple has fallen from the tree, if far at all. You're kind of still trying to chew on that. Now, that the reason for these picks, could more than likely be, for Rouhani trying to appease the conservatives inside the country. And there are some analysts who go as far as saying that Rouhani is actually going to kind of let the conservatives handle the local and domestic issues. As far as culture is concerned, human rights, freedom of the press, minority freedoms, all that stuff. Some analysts believe that Rouhani is not, willing, at least for now, to actually get into a fight with the conservatives over. Iranian conservatives are actually very socially conservative. They have, many of them, deep religious views. So a lot of these issues has been a big point of contention between the reformists and conservatives. And if Rouhani is going to be concerned with kind of big picture issues like the nuclear stuff, sanctions, improving Iran's economy, dealing with the West, he is going to be focusing on that. And then the issues that, more or less people in Iran are going to be impacted by and are going to be concerned by is going to be given to conservatives. So that's what a lot of people are saying. So in order to appease them, in order to not waste time and energy, during his first 100 years or from the get-go, he's going to be kind of easing on that and letting the conservatives handle that. And he's not going to want to raise any issues by appointing, kind of a reform-minded minister of culture, if you will. But again, you know, we keep going back to this, like, attempt by him to create a sense of balance and unity. Now, at the same time, if you look at his education minister, the individual he's picked for that post, I mean, he's a very reform-minded individual. Muhammad Ali Najafi, he is well known for his, you know, reformist work. Supposedly, he's even approached the Supreme Leader personally to ask him to free the opposition leaders. So now you have someone like that also as your, you know, Minister of Education. So, you know, again, as you can see, it's kind of like a very fine balancing game that Rouhani has to play and is trying to play to you know, form this unity government and keep everyone appeased for the time being.
Interesting. So, I mean, I'm sort of seeing shades of Rafsanjani in sort of how Rouhani is sort of administering the government thus far. I mean, it seems like, you know, Rafsanjani, an outline for the audience would be sort of where he's very politically pragmatic, very much focused on the economy, but at the same time didn't really go to lengths, you know, in terms of interfering in domestic sort of social issues and sort of didn't really sort of challenge the ideology of the Islamic Republic, like what we saw with Khatami. So, I mean, do you think that sort of characterization of Rouhani is accurate? Or do you think that, you know, there's a potential that he will sort of, you know, almost be sort of like Khatami and sort of like Rafsanjani? Or is he really just something that is unique or individual and that we have to sort of judge him by his own merits?
No, I think you are, I agree with the former of what you mentioned. Definitely you are correct. You are seeing the same moderate approach that Rafsanjani had when it comes to kind of issues regarding foreign policy, economy, things of that nature. I mean, as I mentioned, a lot of the individuals at kind of like the senior level ministers and advisors that is picked, they come from the executives of Construction Party or Hizb-e Kargar Zaran Sazandagi, which was actually founded by, you know, Rafsanjani and his gang, you know, towards the end of his presidency. So they are, you know, moderates, but as everything else is, everything in Iran is relative. So when we say moderate, you know, they are definitely, you know, having issues that they care a lot about and are, you know, prioritizing. And especially with economy and foreign policy, that's their priority. And that's what they're going to be more than likely focused on. I personally don't believe that Rouhani is going to be inching towards kind of Khatami's approach when it comes to social issues. And I think he's learned his lesson as well. What happened to Khatami and the reform movement and how harsh the reaction was, you know, by the conservative factions in Iran when Khatami was trying to kind of, you know, give minor freedoms to the press and to, you know, authors and various other social, you know, issues and NGOs and whatnot. You know, honestly, it was very, very difficult. And you can say that was maybe kind of what essentially, you know, did the reform movement in after Khatami. And he's still paying for it. I mean, an interesting thing is that, for example, during Rouhani's inauguration and before that, during the endorsement ceremony that Rouhani attended and Supreme Leader endorsed him, Khatami was actually not present. He was supposedly not invited. The head of the parliament's ceremonial office or office of ceremonies actually mentioned that they have not invited Khatami to attend, as far as he knows. So that still kind of shows that, yeah, we are trying to, you know, put together this unity government and everyone's welcomed and everyone's happy, but there's still, you know, certain red lines, you know, and individuals who have crossed these red lines in the past are perhaps, you know, not still welcomed in the fold. And the big elephant in the room is, of course, is still Mousavi and Karoubi. I mean, they're still under house arrest. Will Rouhani actually ask for their release? Is he willing to kind of take on that fight? So we don't know. I mean, that's a very, very, you know, important question that, that it's very difficult to answer right now. And, you know, up until now, we've been just talking about kind of dynamics between various factions in Iran, conservatives, reformists. But there's also a very important point when it comes to popular support. You know, expectations are very high. If people are going to be demanding social freedoms, you know, from an individual that they may have thought was, you know, more reform-minded than his predecessor, like, how far is Rouhani willing to go to keep his popular support? If he gives too much freedoms and too much opening to the people, then he's going to be losing the conservatives again. You know, so there's also that dynamic that, that Rouhani has to grapple with, which is very important.
I mean, that's an interesting dynamic you mentioned. I mean, because it, it seems like Rouhani is very much a, I mean, I hate to use the word insider, I really do, but he really seems like a guy that has been able to sort of network and sort of, you know, been able to sort of go between, you know, the supreme leader and various offices and personalities within Iran's government. But, I mean, this dynamic, I mean, what has been the perception? I mean, sort of expand upon what you just said. I mean, it seems like, you know, his success is predicated on being on being an insider, but yet his position would force him sort of to balance between being a, being somebody who knows all the personalities in Iran's government, while at the same time balancing a sort of responsibility of sort of people who elected him or people who see their vote, you know, that brought him to power. I mean, you know, expand upon this. I mean, is this?
Yeah. You know, no, I think. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
No, you got it. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I mean, no, that's very important, and you know, there are, you know, analysts and experts that go as far as saying that Rouhani's success or failure is going to be depending on the fact that if he can convince Khamenei, can he convince the supreme leader, vis-a-vis the traditional conservatives and followers of the supreme leader, that his policies are worthy of support, his policies are going to work. Now, what the optimists count on is the fact that supposedly Rouhani does have the experience, to use, you know, your phrase, as an insider, to convince Khamenei, and he has in the past. Many credit him for convincing the supreme leader to suspend Iran's nuclear program in the past. Supposedly, he played a key role in convincing the office of the supreme leader himself, that was in the country's national interests at the time. But many of these issues, you know, you are right. I mean, it's yet to be seen. And another question that comes out of this is, will Rouhani himself be paralyzed by the sheer fact that he's trying to please everyone? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, when he is, you know, heading the government, managing the country, he's going to have to make decisions. And at the end of the day, there are going to be some people that are not going to be happy with certain decisions and some that are going to be happy with the outcome. And, you know, again, I hate to make these comparisons, but that's something that perhaps even the Obama administration, some say that suffered from. You know, at first, you know, Obama was trying to kind of play nice with everyone and, like, ask everyone for advice and, you know, bring everyone to the table. And, you know, so will Rouhani kind of be doing the same thing, or will Rouhani at the same time, you know, at the end of the day, he's going to have to cut some people off. I mean, that's what's going to happen. That's the nature of the game. And to quote him, more or less, during his campaign, he said that many of his international policies, you know, when it comes to sanctions, when it comes to appeasing the West on Iran's nuclear program, building trust, he cannot do that and he cannot implement that without popular support. He highlighted, you know, one of the weaknesses of Ahmadinejad's government, especially after 2009, was the fact that, you know, that administration lost popular support. And people in the West saw that, you know, when, you know, we had millions protesting in the street and all that. And he is aware of that, and that's what he mentioned. He said that, I don't want to lose popular support, and the only way I can convince the other governments that, you know, we mean business and I have the power to be representing the Iranian people is to have popular support. But that, again, you know, to go back to what more or less I mentioned, that goes hand in hand with the type of policies that he's willing to implement. And, you know, for the Iranian people, I believe first and foremost is the economy. He seems very serious about that. The people that are close to him, individuals like Nahavandian, you know, the econ minister, these are all, you know, econ experts, economists, individuals that know the economy well. So that's going to be the first priority, to fix the economy, and hopefully in turn is going to, you know, improve his support, or at least keep it at the level that is. But the more controversial, you know, sides of kind of appeasing the people are the social freedoms. You know, will he care about women's rights as far as, you know, giving, you know, maybe women NGOs more power, giving them a more free hand to implement, you know, the social reforms they want? How about minorities? How about, you know, the state of the country's media, various publications, Iranian cinema, arts? We don't know. This is all going to, we're going to have to, you know, wait and see what will happen. But the potential outcome, if he's not to, you know, kind of at least give a few inches to the to the populace and to the people, might be the fact that he's going to lose popular support, or at least decrease kind of his mandate that he has right now.
Before we move on to sort of his 100 days, you know, walk us, I mean, is there a historical tension here? I mean, it seems like what you've described is that, you know, if you try to reform and try to change the ideology and the social freedoms of the Islamic Republic, you end up like Khatam. So you end up isolated from power. You know, nobody in power takes you seriously, and no, you know, you're not invited to, you know, inaugurations. Whereas it seems like, you know, with somebody like Rafsanjani, you know, if you focus on matters of politics and economy, you have some sort of longevity in power circles in Iran, in the Islamic Republic. So I'm curious, I mean, if the characterization of Rouhani is as an insider, as somebody who is more similar to Rafsanjani than Khatami, I mean, it seems like his emphasis would be the economy, politics, and sort of, it almost strikes me that he would shy away from these social issues. I mean, even, you know, I mean, I guess his selection of Pour Mohammadi and, you know, and Jannati would sort of hint at that. So, I mean, is he?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, again, as he, I mean, you hinted at it, the historical power struggle, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you're going to have to make a decision. Like, if I know, you know, as Rouhani, that, you know, giving more social freedoms to the youth, you know, let's concrete example, like the way they dress, you know, am I going to be willing to kind of ease up on the issue, you know, issues regarding that freedom of expression? Let's just put it that way. If that means that I'm going to have to spend a good chunk of my early days of my administration fighting with, you know, the traditional conservatives, fighting with people who actually look at these type of issues as moral, you know, issues, as issues that goes against not just the Islamic Republic, but against Islam and the values preached by Islam. So am I willing to kind of waste and spend that much energy on that? And the outcome of that potentially could be that I lose the conservatives in the process? Or am I just going to kind of ease up on that and tackle the economy, tackle foreign policy, buy some time, improve that, and then maybe, you know, down the road, I will try to, like, tackle that issue or just forget it all at once. So, I mean, that's kind of like that's the calculation that he has to think about, and I'm sure he is. It's also going to depend on how much he cares about popular support. I mean, he has said that he cares. He was still in campaign mode, you know, and it also kind of depends on his perception of how much popular support he can buy by letting a few films that were banned be published now. How much popular support he can buy by letting, you know, women's rights NGOs, human rights NGOs, ethnic issues, all those issues to be, like, improved, highlighted, and, you know, kind of get that world started again, which was somewhat active during Khatami, versus hopefully managing the economy, making that better, and then maybe he can, you know, gain and buy popular support that way. I mean, that's another calculation that he has to make. Maybe he'll rather go that route, you know, before he's willing to kind of take on divisive issues, like some of the social issues that we talked about.
So let's move to, you've written a great article at Foreign Policy, the first 100 days of Rouhani's sort of perspective, his administration. So I'm curious, I mean, within the article, I mean, and we'll post it so everybody can read it, you make a great argument that his focus will be the economy, as you sort of emphasize in our conversation. You know, how will Rouhani sort of decouple the economy, the domestic economy, from issues of, you know, international affairs, sort of like, you know, the nuclear program, sanctions? I mean, is the approach of sort of the Rouhani administration to sort of tackle both of these issues at the same time? I mean, or is it really something, you know, where they're going to try to do as much as they can domestically before stepping into the arena of foreign politics?
I mean, that's a great question. The article you mentioned, actually co-wrote with a good friend of mine, Matthew Reed, and we, you know, try to kind of highlight the complexity of some of these issues and the fact that, as you mentioned, you know, all these problems are intertwined, you know, so you want to fix the economy, you have to deal with the sanctions issue, then you have to address the nuclear issue. And the way I see it, the problem with the economy is kind of like it has two fronts. The domestic front is just the gross mismanagement of the economy by the Ahmadinejad, administration, you know, the way he implemented the subsidy reform programs. And I think the first phase was somewhat implemented. I'm pretty sure, don't quote me, I'm not an econ expert, but I don't think the second phase was really ever implemented or at least implemented the way they wanted it. You know, he is dealing with lack of key organizations when it comes to managing the economy. In 07, Ahmadinejad shut down and dissolved the management and planning organization in Iran. That organization, like one of the, it was a semi-independent institution that was actually employed by, that employed dozens of seasoned economists, and it actually existed even before the revolution. So the institutional memory of that organization you can just imagine. He just dissolved it and then created this like other institution directly under the supervision of the office of the president in order for him to actually be able to implement any policy he wants without any opposition from the semi-independent planning organization. So that's, you know, these are type of, and I'm just going to give you just tidbits, you know, the management of economy domestically was poorly done. So that's something that Rouhani at least more or less has control over. He doesn't have to deal with external factors. Now, with the external stuff, I think one of the things that he's going to do first, and he has more or less said that, is to build trust again within the international community, to actually try to convince the international community that the Iranian nuclear program is peaceful and they're willing to cooperate and they're willing to genuinely negotiate over the details, you know, of the program. So that's the way he's hoping to kind of reduce Iran's isolation and perhaps, you know, lift some of the sanctions. And I think at his inaugural, he actually made this speech and said that Iran will not respond well to language of sanctions. Iran only responds to language of respect, which, you know, you can take it, you know, however you want to take that phrase. But I think he is, you know, trying to, again, reinforce kind of the fact that Iran wants to play, you know, within the international arena, should be respected as an international actor, and is willing to, you know, conduct in a respectable negotiation. And so that's kind of it. And as far as the nuclear issue itself, we're going to have to wait and see. I'm not sure how much, you know, the administration is willing to negotiate over what the details are going to be. Is it going to boil down to the number of centrifuges? Is it going to boil down to the percentage of the uranium enriched, or are the, is Iran willing to just stop enrichment altogether? Unlikely, but who knows? But I think that's more or less what Rouhani is going to do. First, he's going to try to get the house in order domestically, you know, put together the organizations he needs, hire the individuals that he needs, try to get a sense of what is missing and what needs to be implemented right away to kind of you know, get a handle on his books, so to speak, domestically. And then he's going to be tackling, hopefully, the international issues. Now, that doesn't mean that he's not going to be actually reaching abroad simultaneously. By first and second, I didn't mean like in order. I think domestic is what he more or less can handle, or he feels like he can handle. And then internationally, it takes two to tango. It also depends on how the Western world is going to be taking Rouhani, his new approach, and the new rhetoric coming out of Iran.
Interesting. So let me ask, you know, how will sort of Syria change this? I mean, is Rouhani, I mean, in his public speeches, you know, offering a sort of different route in regards to Syria? And, you know, in that sense, you know, is Syria sort of, you know, even if they change route on the nuclear issue, I mean, do you think Syria and Iran's involvement in Syria would shape international opinion much more than, you know, any change of behavior in regards to the nuclear issue?
That's a great question. I think it's different. I mean, for the most part, I feel like Iran-Syria policy will remain on autopilot, or is on autopilot. It, at the end of the day, I don't think Rouhani will make any decisions that goes against the national interests of Iran, and it seems like that for the most part, Iranian diplomats and politicians are united on, and I'm talking about like people like in Iran, not the opposition outside, that Iran's, you know, take on Syria is very important when it comes to Iran's national interest, especially in relations with Hezbollah. And we can perhaps see some of the rhetoric easing a little bit, but as far as tangible steps are concerned, you know, if anyone is expecting that, you know, Iran will all of a sudden decide not to, you know, meddle in Syrian issues, or all of a sudden it's going to stop, you know, supporting the Assad regime, I would be personally shocked if I see that happening. I think Iran sees Assad government as a you know, important piece of the puzzle in its regional relations. It's you know, kind of regional ambitions and the way that it sees the region. Syria plays a key role in that, and Assad regime plays a key role in that. I'm not sure. I think this would be a better question to ask, you know, Western analysts on will the Syrian issue kind of overshadow the nuclear issue? I don't think so. But they're such different, you know, topics that I find it hard to kind of give you like a clear answer, or, you know, like a yes and no answer. But I think for the regional countries, the Syrian issue is definitely very important for the majority of the Arab nations, if not all. Syria seems to be their first priority for the time being. And, you know, for the longest time, Iran has actually been saying that they want to negotiate with the West over the Syrian issue. Now, negotiation doesn't mean that they're going to be, you know, kind of giving into what the Western demands are, but Iran is trying to separate the two issues. You know, the nuclear file is one thing, the Syrian file is another thing, but for the most part, in the Western world, it seems like until the nuclear issue is not resolved, until Iran is not looked at as a kind of positive player in the region, any other negotiations would be kind of meaningless. That's at least, you know, I could be wrong, but that's the sense I've been getting from the Western policymakers.
So for our last question, we always ask, you know, did we leave anything out? You know, do you want to add anything, or do you want, you know, because, you know, our last question always sort of, you know, gives the guest the last word and the last say.
I mean, I think we pretty much covered a lot of the things. I guess I'll just, you know, take the opportunity to just highlight just a couple of important points that were brought up in our discussion. I think Rouhani's administration, you know, has an immense task ahead. The challenges are numerous. We have, you know, them trying to form this unity government and at the same time trying to send the strong signals abroad and rebuild regime legitimacy and position within the international community. So the task at hand is immense, and it seems like the Rouhani administration has recognized this, is trying to put together the best of the best, best seasoned, non-ideological technocrats, which is a challenge on its own, because you have to keep, you know, both sides, reformists and conservatives, happy and content about your picks. At the same time, you know, you are dealing with the supreme leader. He's still in the room. He hasn't left. And any major, you know, agenda decisions or policy decisions, you have to kind of clear the supreme leader or make sure that he's content with. So that's another very, very big concern for previous governments experienced it, and it's a concern for Rouhani's government as well. And that's pretty much it. I think that's that does nicely. I mean, I know we talked about a lot of things, but the gist of the matter is I think that you're dealing with a bunch of technocrats now, and the government is going to be a lot less ideological than the previous administration.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Sinan. I really appreciate it.